Welcome to Tilly's Trans Tuesdays. August is Trans History Month, and it's such an important topic that so many people get wrong or know nothing about. So let's dive into Trans History 1, how and why we name trans people in history. Hi, I'm Tilly Bridges, your host, and I'm joined by my writing partner, my best friend, my wife, our token cis representation, the lady who's the best part of my history, Susan Bridges.
Hello.
Our guest this week is Nico Mara McKay, a Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada-funded PhD student at the University of Toronto in history with a collaborative specialization in sexual diversity studies. Their research focuses on non-normative gender expressions in late medieval France. Welcome, Nico.
Hi, thank you. Sorry, that's a mouthful, I know.
It's very impressive, though, and you're the perfect guest for these two episodes. I really wanted to have you on this one and the one that will be coming next week. But I wanted to ask you, what drew you to history, especially studying the sexual diversity of it? Is that something you've always been interested in?
Yes, in part because none of it's made sense to me. So I'm a child of the 80s. When we were told, like, boys and girls be equal, all things are the same. But then the lived experience of that, once you start to hit about 5 or 6 years old, that disappears. There are certain gender clothes you're supposed to wear. There are certain gendered toys you're supposed to play with. There are certain gendered activities you're supposed to participate in. And so the boys and girls can do anything, or girls can do anything that boys can do, turned out not to be true. And so this has been a point of disappointment for me for my entire life.
Sure.
And so I wanted to find out kind of the roots of that. And for me, history was the way to find, to access like real people, real problems, real questions, and find out the evolution of the ideas of how we came to gender different things in certain ways, how contextual it is, how contingent it is upon place and culture. So it's been a really fascinating area of study for me.
Well, I think it's really cool. Like, I remember, like, you never heard anything about the existence at all of any kind of trans person, like in school, in history classes, right? There was always men and women, and that's all there ever were. And they were all cis, and you didn't hear the word cis. It was just presumptive. And so I feel like, you know, that harms us in so many ways, because I didn't even know that trans people really were a thing until I was an adult, you know? And it's like my whole life would have been different if we would just be like, hey, we've always been around. And so I think it's great that there's folks like you out there studying that and finding all of those little bits of us that have been sort of lost to time, or in some cases, unfortunately, as we're going to get into in the discussion, intentionally hidden. But we will get there. So for you, what has been the best thing about transitioning?
Best thing? So transitioning is kind of like a fraught concept for me, because it's not something that I fully understand either. Like, as a child, I always understood that I wasn't a girl and I wasn't a boy. And so
sure.
I didn't seem to have a, there was no language for that in the 80s and in the early 90s. So when I would say that I, you know, didn't want to do certain things, or like when I would always be put into one team or the other, it was just like, that's not, that didn't feel good, like sports teams and health class and different things like that. It was like, this doesn't reflect who I am. So I tried to communicate that, but I would usually get bullied or sometimes physically abused and things like that by fellow students and things like that.
Yeah.
So I learned to kind of like suppress expressions of that, but I still never felt like that. So the idea of transitioning is weird to me, because it's like when I was 12, I was put into an arts program in my grade school. And so then I took on a new name, which had a boy spelling and a girl spelling. So I decided I would create my own spelling so that it wasn't either
of those. I love that.
And I was celebrated for my creativity of the spelling, instead of being put down, which I usually was. So this was actually like a welcome thing. And it took a long time to get people to use this name in my family, all the friends and teachers and stuff. It was really, really straightforward to just have them use the new name, and it was fine. So like, was that when I started transitioning? Was it when I got to choose my clothes when I was 8 and 9, when I got to have a little more say over not wearing the things that my mother would try and force me into? Was it when I finally first heard the word genderqueer in my 20s and decided, oh, there's a name for how I feel. There's a word for this.
Yeah.
Was it when I had top surgery in my 30s? Was it when I started HRT last year? Like the idea of transitioning is not, it's not like transitioning sounds like there's a starting point and an end point, and that you finish transitioning and then you are a person of some kind. For me, that narrative doesn't make a lot of sense because I felt like I'm the same person throughout this entire process. What's changed is some of it is my relationship to these ideas and terms and my understanding of myself, but a lot of it's also in how other people perceive me. So people, even though I came out as genderqueer in my late 20s, early 30s, and started using they, them pronouns in my 30s, people didn't consider me trans until I started HRT. Like even though I had top surgery like 2 years prior,
Yeah.
like it was really, really weird. So
Really bad,
what
but
does transitioning mean
yeah.
for me versus what does it mean for other people perceiving
Yeah.
me? Like it's just a concept that I just that doesn't make sense for me personally. Like I
Sure.
understand that other people it resonates and it's a beautiful story and it makes sense and there's a narrative there. For me, it's one that I struggle with, I guess I could say.
Well, you know what? That is understandable and really fascinating because I have not met a lot of people who have that perspective on things, because like the fact that you got to choose your own clothes and things when you were 8 or 9 is really amazing, because I wasn't allowed to do that. You know, it was, I mean, I could as long as it fell within boy clothes, you know what I mean? I couldn't experiment outside of that. And the fact that you had that ability and that you've sort of always felt like yourself, different versions of yourself, but that's amazing. And that's a completely different experience, I think, that maybe like the majority of trans people have. Those people who didn't consider you trans, I mean, I want to punch them in the face. I hate
There's
that
cis people too,
gatekeeping crap.
right? Yeah.
It's horrible. But I'm glad that you talked about that, because that is a very unique and interesting perspective. And I know that, you know, you're obviously not alone in that. There are people like that out there, like you, that have had that same experience. And so I'm glad that you talked about it, just so we could get that out there, so other people who have that experience, like you, know that they are not alone and that they are trans and they're just as vital a part of this community as everybody else is. So I love that. And that's okay that you don't have an answer to that question then.
I
It's
did
totally
say, like,
fine.
when I said I could choose my clothes, that meant that I still had to choose from a certain gendered section that was inappropriate for how I
Oh,
felt. But
okay.
I could choose the plainest version of it. Like, I didn't have frills or unicorns or animals or hearts or the
Yeah.
things that were on it. So I tried to find, like, the most plain version of anything that I could. So, like, I had limited things to work with, but yeah, I did my best. It's in the
We're
hand-me-down.
all doing our best, right? That's
Yeah, very
all we can
tough.
do, especially in this world.
Dirtbag Henry is here.
Oh, we have a visit from our cat. He
hates cuddles.
he's terrible. Is this his
Oh,
first appearance on the show?
buddy.
Oh, he might have been heard meowing in the background before, but all right. Well, before we get into our main discussion then, do you want to let folks know where they can find you online if they'd like to learn more about Nico after listening?
Sure. You can find me at nicomaramckay.com, which is my website, as all one word. And you can find me on Blue Sky at pluropsyche.nicomaramckay.com. And those two places will take you to other things like my Patreon, which is ephemeral records of queer and trans histories and other things like that.
Excellent. Go follow them. All right. I am not a historian. I'm not an expert in trans history, though I do find it fascinating. I myself have a lot to learn on the topic, but one thing I do know is that there have always been trans people. Trans is just something you are, like gay or bi or cis or blonde or brown-eyed or left-handed. And there's nothing in the world that could suddenly make people transgender that didn't exist before, the same as with gay people. Nothing makes you gay or straight or trans or bi or cis. It's just how and who you are. But I've encountered cis people who just don't know that, who have never thought about it. And if I'm here to help people understand, and I absolutely am, then this is something I've got to talk about, because it's information a lot of people are lacking. As I am not an expert historian, this means I'm going to quote and link you to a lot of other people who've done the work in uncovering and talking about trans people in history. I've done the work in collecting their evidence and articles, and now you must do the work in reading to understand. But it is good work, I would not lie to you. So how do we spot trans people in history, especially when the rules for understanding history were written by cis people who didn't know how to spot transness or didn't want to spot transness or actively hid transness? Well, I'm so glad you asked, because do I ever have the answers for you? I actually got into an argument with a cis historian about this very topic and how trans people have been so erased from history that it's vital for us to look back and find examples that we've always existed. And she was adamant that you could not do so because it would be disrespectful to the person in question since they couldn't call themselves trans. But that doesn't make them any less trans. The earliest humans didn't have the word to call themselves humans, but that doesn't mean that they weren't humans. Looking back to find trans people in history is about respecting them in the ways their cultures and societies of the time perhaps refused to do. So let's hear what some trans and non-binary history experts have to say on the topic, who I've quoted with permission. I had this exchange with history teacher Lucas Christodoulou at Lucas, L-O-U-K-A-S, at mastodon.nu on Mastodon. Me. Would you say there's a divide among cis historians over this? Because I've spoken with some cis historians who told me unequivocally they could never say someone from the past would be described as transgender today, even while then saying they would describe them as someone whose gender didn't align with that assigned at birth, which is the literal definition of transgender. And in the course of methodology and whatnot historians use was established by cishet white men in the US and Europe anyway, who often don't know how to spot transness, weren't looking for it, were actively hiding it, or thought it was a mental illness and likened it to not diagnosing people from history with mental illnesses because we can't talk to them to be sure. But trans is an identity, not an illness, and it seems to me we have a duty to try to find our legacy. Lucas. Yes, that attitude you describe is very familiar to me. Partly it stems from historical methodology, but even more it comes from how the establishment of what is quote-unquote real is political and under debate. For example, 100 years ago, military historians debated whether battle trauma was quote-unquote real, or whether it would be wrong to read the modern phenomenon of shell shock into Roman times. Nowadays, all historians accept trauma as a universal human experience and it's no longer controversial. Also, the local political environment will influence what is acceptable to research and to say. I can imagine that a school and other public historians in Florida and Hungary would have a hard time publishing material on trans experiences in history, even if that research is based on prestigious journals in England or Massachusetts, because they would face hate and even prosecution.
That's a lot to unpack there.
Right? I had this exchange with historian Sandra Bosley, who has a history blog at relicontheleffy.blogspot.com. Sandra, we would generally try to not, quote, put words into someone's mouth without a lot of really careful research. It's much harder to verify the internal feelings and longings of past figures, especially if they left no documented proof of their inner life. It's much the same caution good psychologists have about diagnosing past historic figures with mental illness. You can draw conclusions from actions and statements, but you can't do any diagnostic tests on them now. Me. But transness is different, as it's an identity and not an illness. And given so much of our society, including the methodology of how we look back and interpret history, was established by cishet white men, many of whom didn't care about transness, wouldn't have known how to spot it, or actively work to cover it up, and who might also have seen transness as a mental illness, as that's how the medical community errantly treated it for so long, do you feel that plays a part in some cis historians' complete inability or disinterest in naming clear signs of transness in history? Sandra, I do think that may be part of it. Anytime I've seen older accounts by our white male historian predecessors, it's almost always lacking any kind of nuance or interpretation of statements that may have been made by the subject. It's usually treated as a medical slash social curiosity, and the older the source, the worse the dismissiveness. Some of it is also prudishness of the times. I do mostly Victorian-era research these days, and while it was almost expected for two spinster ladies to live together, any hint of lesbianism was purged. The number of times I've come across "they were just good friends," emphasis was mine, and the like is amusingly high. It's usually only more recent researchers who can get to letters and whatnot that were essentially censored and now show they had much more affection for each other. I would not be surprised if much supporting evidence there may have been for anything scandalous about a person was deliberately destroyed or obfuscated. So So it seems to me that there is, in fact, a complete reticence in cis historians to call trans people trans. Okay, so Nico, I wanted to ask what your experience in the field has been with this. Has it been a fight for you to get cis people to come around to naming transness in history?
I still encounter this resistance. I haven't published a lot of my academic work on this yet. I'm still a PhD student, so I'm still in the process of doing a lot of my research.
Sure.
But yes. So, like, I mean, so you do encounter this a lot where people say that, you know, no one can be called trans prior to the point of the term and things like that as well. But we have to kind of disentangle, I think, trans as an identity from trans as an analytical tool to understand the past. So we do this with queer history a lot too, and homosexual history. So you have homosexual as an analytical category that you can say, oh, these two people had sex, they were both men. This is definitely a homosexual encounter. There is, even if they had wives and children and stuff like
right.
that, you know that this is clinically defined as a homosexual encounter. You similarly can do the same thing with transgender. We do have records of people who were assigned one gender at birth and then lived as another gender throughout much or most of their life. And so if we take Susan Stryker's definition of transgender as a person whose lived experience is different than the gender that they were assigned at birth, that is the definition of transgender. So we can analytically say that this person is transgender based on how they lived their life and how they started their life. Whether they would have identified as transgender in our modern understanding of the term, that we cannot know. Like that, there's
right.
there's no way possibly to know that. If that term would have resonated with them, if it would have made cultural sense to them, like there's a lot of things that would have to go into that for the person to understand the concept and integrate it into their personal self-identity. But certainly we can say that, yes, this person lives as a gender other than the one they were assigned at birth, therefore they are transgender. And you see this a lot in, I say a lot, this comes up in textual accounts as well, where you have like stories of people who cross gender. You get a lot of it in medieval tales, which is the area that I study.
But you've encountered like already then cis people who are like, we can't do that, even when it's like plain as day. Like I know some cases are much harder to determine than others based on historical records that we have or don't have. But sometimes mm-hmm. it seems so completely obvious. And I've still at least encountered cis historians who are like, well, we just can't do it. And it's so frustrating to me because we need it so badly.
Yeah, there are, but there are also trans historians who are doing this work and cis historians who are doing
yeah,
this
yeah.
work. So as the first person that you cited, Lucas,
yeah,
had mentioned that there's reticence in the past, but you do see a shift moving over the last 20, 30 years, especially the
okay.
last 20 years, of people starting to say, oh, yes, this is a thing, and here's how we can name it and define it and understand it and interpret it. So some of the sources that were previously read as one thing are being reinterpreted as another. And I think we'll get into the case of Eleanor Reichner at some point. An excellent demonstration of the shift in thinking that has happened over the last 30 years.
Yeah.
I mean, so much has changed in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
For so many things.
That's true.
I mean, even how we grew up, where queer wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
It just wasn't talked about. Or it was so hard for me to accept that I was queer because I had nothing around me to support me in that way.
Or tell you that it was okay.
Right.
Or, yeah.
You know, I just like clothes. No. You like the girls wearing the clothes.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was like no trans mask representation when I was a kid.
Yeah, right. And it's still not great, but it's better. It's getting better.
Yeah.
But it still has a long way to go. But do you think part of the reason that it is getting better is because there are more trans and non-binary historians now in the field that are acceptance for a little while of people who are not cis got a little better before it got as rough as it is right now. And mm-hmm. so, you know, more of us came out, and I wonder, like, do you think that there's more trans and non-binary, or just plain non-cis, I guess, to cover everybody, people in the history field now that is helping push it things that way?
Yeah. So I was surprised when I started my PhD. It was in 2020 during COVID lockdowns and things like that. So a lot of the courses and things that I was doing were online. And I was surprised that in most of my classes, I wasn't the only trans or non-binary and non-binary person in those classrooms. There were other people.
Yeah.
Which I don't think would have been the case 15 years ago if
right.
I had done this, or 20 years ago if I'd done this when I was supposed to, allegedly, since I'm doing this as an older student.
Sure.
Yeah, so I think things have changed a lot. Like access has changed a lot. The university has changed a lot. The expectations for these things have changed. And it's just a larger cultural shift, I think, is part of this as well. As the internet changed a lot of things for a lot of people, I think that's a huge part of it.
Yeah,
Well, and who people who
exactly.
are isolated have a chance to connect together and come together and discuss things with each other and develop ideas of identity and who they are and share in ways that weren't possible before. And so I know a lot of people take that for granted now, but it was, things were different.
They were very, very different. Yeah. Well, there is a fairly big project I'm working on about a figure from history not previously thought of as trans. And if you follow my social media, you know exactly who I'm talking about. But the research ended up going so much deeper than I thought, so I'm still in the middle of that and will be for a while. But as part of it, I read up a little on queer people in Victorian times, and I found a book all about that, LGBT Victorians, Sexuality and Gender in the 19th Century Archives by Simon Joyce. And then I read this little excerpt that I'm going to read you here in the introduction on page 5. In describing historical figures in this book, I have used my best judgment about which terms are most suited to which person, in part to sidestep what are often political or interpretive arguments that masquerade as being simply about historical realities. I discuss some of these arguments in the chapters that follow, particularly about when and in what circumstances it is appropriate to apply a label such as, quote, lesbian to 19th century people and about whether the existence of transgender individuals pre-existed 20th century technologies enabling gender confirmation surgery. And then I hurled the book into the sun because this is just perpetuating transmedicalism. And like, how many times do I have to yell this? It is not medical procedures or interventions that make you trans. Those are just things to address being trans and make life better for you. To even debate if trans people existed before the advent of gender confirmation surgeries? What the country fried hell? See episode 60 of this show on transmedicalism and WPATH version 1 to learn how everything about that could not be more wrong. Yes, it's fine, nay, in fact, required, I think, to label trans people in history as trans. Here's a quote from the book Others of My Kind, Transatlantic Transgender Histories, and the chapter Historicizing Transgender Terminology. There is a link to this in the show notes. Its trans historian authors had this to say about labeling transness in history. From the beginning, the category transgender represented a resistance to medicalization, to pathologization, and to the many mechanisms whereby the administrative state and its associated medico-legal psychiatric institutions sought to contain and delimit the socially disruptive potentials of sex/gender atypicality, incongruence, and non-normativity. For precisely these reasons, we chose to use the words transgender or trans fairly interchangeably whenever we are discussing the experiences of transgender people from a point of historical remove. These are our words to describe their experience, though we believe that they are respectful and appropriate. Respectful and appropriate. Look what happens when trans people are talked to and involved with our history. Imagine cis historians thinking that wasn't something they needed to do. My rage could power the sun. Nico, I wanted to ask if you'd encountered that kind of transmedicalism in the field where they think that trans people couldn't have existed before gender confirmation surgeries existed.
Less in my work, just because I do medieval history, so like gender confirmation surgeries were almost not a thing. Like my master's
Yeah.
project was on intersex people in a medical text from medieval France, where gender confirmation surgery was performed on cis women, or the recommendation was that gender confirmation surgery be performed on cis women with unusually large genitalia. So this was
Huh.
to reduce the size of their clitoris to make them more normatively feminine.
Right.
There's no record that I know of anyway of this surgery actually being performed, but it was something that was recommended in the medical textbook and was starting to be, as surgery was starting to become defined as its own field, subfield of medicine, that was starting to gain legitimacy as a more than just like barber surgeon. A much larger history that I don't need to get into. But
Whoa.
basically, so there were very few gender affirming surgeries that were possible
Yeah.
in pre-modern times. So there isn't an expectation in kind of work that I do that a trans woman would have any sort of gender-affirming surgery or be on HRT. So I think I've encountered less of that concern and more of the language concern of labeling someone as trans when that might not be their, as you said, their identity. There's also an association with that of trans being something negative, and so you wouldn't want to
Yeah.
put a label on someone that's negative, and I think that's very problematic.
Yeah, absolutely is. Here are some excerpts that I'd like to read to you from an article from the American Historical Association about this very topic. There is also a link to this in the show notes. In transgender history, Stryker uses transgender to, quote, refer to people who move away from the gender they were assigned at birth, end quote. Even though the term only emerged in the mid-20th century, many scholars find this definition useful and methodologically liberating. Emily Skidmore, Texas Tech University, author of the recently published True Sex, The Lives of Trans Men at the Turn of the 20th Century, says, quote, even though the term transgender is modern, people have moved from one gender to another for a very long time, and transgender history looks at that movement, end quote. Historians must grapple with the so-called medical model, which assumes that transgender expression requires bodily intervention through surgery or hormones, for example. Baker encourages historians to push trans history back into the more distant past, especially before the development of modern medical technology. This, he says, can help us think about, quote, what it was like for people to change their identities without changing their bodies, end quote. And then another quote, the transgender experience isn't only about medical intervention, end quote, he emphasizes. Some scholars acknowledge that trans history and trans studies have met with some backlash. The AHA's 2015 LGBTQ Task Force report includes the experience of a historian who said they faced rejection from a blind reviewer of a U.S. history journal who called their work in applying trans studies to U.S. history a, quote, manifesto rather than a scholarship. In another, more public instance, in 2017, several trans scholars called for a boycott of WMST-L, a popular women's studies online discussion group, after moderators failed to intervene in discussions that insisted on biological reproduction as an essential marker of what it means to be a woman.
That's icky.
Yeah. And are you getting what we're up against? Why are trans people looking for those like us in history treated as a, quote, manifesto with a secret agenda and not simply seeking the truth that had been overlooked? This next one I'm going to read to you, I was made aware of by Nico when we were having a trans people in history discussion on Blue Sky. In Transhistorical, Gender Plurality Before the Modern, a chapter written by Dr. Gabrielle Bykowski that is specifically about naming a trans woman from history whose transness was erased, includes this excerpt. Most scholarship is, effectively, cisgender scholarship, not only because it is mostly cisgender scholars who have claimed the education and tools to publish it, but also because most scholarship assumes the cisgender status of any character or historical figure who is presented to readers. Some have called this prejudice cissexism because it represents the privileging of cisgender perspectives and identities. Institutional cissexism, in turn, has made it easier for cisgender scholars to claim and maintain greater academic authority than trans scholars. As a result, the arrival of transgender scholars, especially in fields such as medieval studies, marks a late arriving turn in the field. Simultaneously, because of the compulsory cisgender assignment of history and historical figures, historical people have already been coded by cisgender norms. As a result, trans readings do not immediately spring to mind as the primary readings, which, if you look critically, is nothing short of astonishing. Nonetheless, cisgender readings of texts and histories have been dominant for so long they are treated as neutral. This can make it difficult for trans readings to enter academic discourse because transgender studies can be seen as offering modern additions to long-established traditions within cisgender histories and studies. Trans studies is seen as an act of remaking or rewriting history. Neither the text nor the person was necessarily cisgender until cisgender scribes, scholars, and readers marked them as such. I'm so glad you sent that to me, Nico. It must have been such a breath of fresh air to find. Do you feel like there has been, I mean, you said a little bit that it is getting better in the field now. Do you find more things like this cropping up where more trans scholars are getting to talk about transness in history as opposed to cis people, you know, speaking for us or saying no, that could not have been?
Yeah, so within the past 5 years, there have been at least four or five different books that focused on trans history in the era that I study, medieval trans studies, which is the same that Bykowski does.
Yeah.
The same field. And who, like, he's the person who coined medieval trans studies as well as a defining term for it, which is amazing. So yeah, when I read this, I cried. I was so happy that somebody named this and put words to it.
Yeah.
She so openly shares her experiences of what it was has been like for her to do this work in this field. And yeah, it's a very powerful essay.
Yeah, like that was, I think, reading that is what fully opened my eyes to exactly what she said, that there's this presumption of cisness that people look back at people and like, well, you know, they can't be trans unless there's hard evidence for it, but otherwise they're going to be cis when there's no hard evidence that they were cis either. You know what I mean? It's so, I didn't realize the prevalence of that just sort of assumption until I read that, and I was like, that is exactly what had happened, you know, that all through school when I learned history, everybody was presumed cis, and it's just, it's wild. Well, for the final word on spotting and naming trans people in history, I'm going to share with you some excerpts from Before We Were Trans, A New History of Gender by Dr. Kit Hayem, which is a wonderful book that you should absolutely check out. We look for evidence that their motivation for gender nonconformity was not external but internal, identity in the form of personal testimony. We look for continuous presentation as the gender, quote, opposite to the one they were assigned at birth. And we look for histories that we can fit into contemporary Western ideas of what it means to be trans. Even if those criteria are met, we get anxious if the person we're dealing with lived before the advent of terminology that we use to talk about trans identities today. Often, this in itself is enough to dismiss their trans possibility altogether. These criteria often make it difficult for us to talk about trans history at all. What makes this conversation even more difficult to have are the concepts that underpin it. Gender and sex, internal and external motivations, personal testimony, stability of identity. If we poke at any one of these concepts, the whole edifice starts to crumble. When we talk about trans history, what are we even talking about? Talking about being trans as an identity rather than an action helps us to understand transness as relating to who you are, not what you do, a crucial step in undermining the argument that transitioning means adhering to gender stereotypes. It makes space for people who can't or don't want to transition socially or medically, and talking about moving away from the gender we were assigned at birth rather than from male to female or vice versa helps our definition to be clearly inclusive of non-binary people. This is the problem. The trans histories that we point to most often are the easy stories. They are stories of people who lived stably in a gender distinct from the one they were assigned at birth. People who, even if they didn't have access to the word transgender, lived recently enough to fit easily into modern Western understandings of sex and gender, people who pursued medical transition if they had access to it, people from whom we have firsthand testimony saying that they wanted to be recognized as the gender they lived in. The second problem with our existing criteria for inclusion in trans history is that they privilege an incredibly narrow version of what it means to be trans. The trans histories we tend to tell are those that conform to the trans narrative that's centered and recapitulated in contemporary media. It has no space for the histories of people who can't articulate their gender clearly or resist the imperative to do so. One of the reasons is that historical methodology, the way we're accustomed to doing and thinking about history academically, tends to demand a much higher standard of evidence to prove, quote-unquote prove, that someone in the past can be called trans than it does to quote-unquote prove that they can be called cis. Because trans people are a minority, we're seen as an aberration from the norm. Our society treats cisgenderness as the default, or quote-unquote unmarked, state of all human beings. This is compounded for anyone whose body is seen as non-normative. In white Western culture, this includes not only trans people, but also intersex people, disabled people, and people of color. The pervasive cisnormity means that the cis perspective is, just like the male perspective, positioned as objective truth. This means historians tend to interpret people from the past as effectively cis until proven otherwise. Nico, in your studies working toward your doctorate, have you had to fight a presumption of cisness that you find in like the text that you're reading or in your research about people in history?
Yes. Broadly speaking, yes. Like I say it's getting better, but I mean that among like the students mostly that I've been working with. We have professors who still don't see a problem with saying that there's no such thing as trans people before 1971, the time was coined, or things like that. So, and yeah. You still have people who say that these things still do persist.
Yeah.
But there is definitely a greater burden of proof upon anything that's non-normative to justify why you can make this claim. But I also think that because I position my work explicitly within legal trans studies and frame my terms very carefully, this is something that I was taught how to do in doing my master's especially. And I think that's mitigated some of the pushback that I might have otherwise received. But we'll see what challenges go forward as I, look to publish more of my work. That will kind
Yeah.
of be a real test, I think.
Have you run into the issue where people think that us simply trying to find or name trans people in history and correct a inaccurate record of them being labeled cis is that we have an agenda or the quote unquote manifesto? It feels to me like there is actually a cis quote unquote manifesto, with the presumption, well, we're going to presume everybody is cis. That feels much more like an agenda to me than us simply trying to find inaccurate records about us and correct them.
Yeah, they kind of go in stages. Like you found this with women's history in the 70s too, where you had this like recuperative process where you go and find women who were in history and bring them forward as like exemplars. These are like women in history who did history, figures who existed and can be pointed to. And so you're
Yeah.
finding that sort of thing with trans history as well. It's like, here, this is an obviously trans person. We are naming and making this obvious to people. And so we're starting to get that recuperative process of like finding them and naming them and telling their stories. And then you get more theoretical work and it becomes just a part of a historical narrative. I think over time, you still find like women in history, like cis women in history, broadly speaking, are the exceptions in some periods. Like you have a lot of stories of kings and leaders and warlords who do different things, and then very few women who are
Yeah.
talked about in these settings. And so you're, but at the same time, you start to see the recognition that yes, there's importance to telling women's history as well and to incorporating that. And I think we're hopefully starting to. I would like us to see a turn towards also including other trans and queer histories in classrooms for students of all ages, just as a normal part of human experience, people who lived, people who died, people who did interesting things, people who were
Yeah.
important just because they existed.
Yeah, that's how we change the world. And I'm glad at least that among the students you've seen it getting better. That gives me hope for the future. Because this is something, we really need to correct out there. And this has been a wonderful talk. And thank you so much for being here, Nico.
Thanks for having me.
Given everything I've collected and laid out for you in this episode, hopefully you see the urgent, vital need for trans people to look through history and find ourselves. To respect those who came before in ways the world didn't and still doesn't, to sing the song of their truth that they never got to sing. Next week, we're going to do just that and look at a whole bunch of examples of trans people in history. Don't miss it. Tilly Bridges and Transmission. Tilly's Trans Tuesdays is hosted by Tilly Bridges and Susan Bridges, with audio editing and sound mixing by Jillian Morgan. The Google Doc and social media versions of this week's topic and all past topics are available at TillysTransTuesdays.com. Special thanks to Daisy and Jane for the use of Sorry Not Sorry as our show's theme music. Please stop by and show your support at daisyandjane.bandcamp.com and soundcloud.com/daisyandjane. You can find me at Tilly Bridges on Blue Sky, Twitter, and Hive, on Mastodon at tillybridges@mastodon.social, at facebook.com/TillySBridges, and on Insta and Threads at HeckYeahTillyBridges. And you can find Susan on most of those at Susan L. Bridges. You can find Jillian at AudioJillian on Blue Sky. You can join the Tillyverse Discord server by following the link at the very bottom of TillysTransTuesdays.com. We hold regular watch parties for the Matrix films and other trans movies, where I do a live Q&A. And it's blossomed into a wonderfully supportive, compassionate, kind community of friends. We'd love to have you join us. For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.